And you're listening to the Religion and Ethics Report here on RN, and I'm Andrew West.
They regard me as the best prospect to lead the Australian Labor Party successfully to the next elections, to save the Australian Labor Party at those elections, and to save the country from the ravages of an Abbott government.
I think we need to get out of this idea that Kevin is a messiah who will deliver an election back to us. That is just, I think, fanciful.
Isn't Kevin the messiah just a bit too much to ask people to believe, number one? And number two, it's becoming increasingly evident that most of his colleagues don't want him, in which case, what is the point of running?
Well, I don't think he's a messiah at all. I think he's a naughty boy.
Now, can a religious person stay humble in the ego-driven world of politics? Is it okay for a Christian politician to take revenge or get square on an opponent? And what about the Bible telling us and the pollies to love our enemies? Well, if you're a Christian in the Federal Parliamentary Labor Party, this past week or so you may have found yourself right in the middle of just such a dilemma. As you know, the former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd challenged Julia Gillard to reclaim his old job. He lost. But along the way, Kevin Rudd, who is a committed and practicing Anglican, made some bold claims. I got together two experts, Father Frank Brennan, who's perhaps Australia's most well-known Jesuit priest, a lawyer, and a friend of Kevin Rudd's, and Scott Stevens, the editor of the ABC's Religion and Ethics website. And I started by asking Frank Brennan whether Mr. Rudd had somewhat overstepped the bounds of Christian humility in suggesting he could be a saviour to his party and his country.
That's simply a question of political calculation. Is it prudent? Is it wise? Is it sensible? What are the consequences likely to be if you're out there saying, I'm the one to save the country, I'm the one to save the government, I'm the one to save the party? My quandary, once it was on, was what does a person do who's trying to act in good faith, in accordance with conscience, and perhaps in accordance with their religious beliefs? There are all sorts of assessments we make about things just in terms of political consequences. So, for example, some of the things that were said by some of the Gillard supporters I thought were very mean and nasty. Therefore, I thought they were actually counterproductive. What did they actually change? Now, you could just keep the argument to the level of consequences. What works, what doesn't? There were others of Gillard's supporters who didn't engage in that sort of behaviour, people like Smith and Plibersek, who I thought retained their own dignity, still contributed to the political debate, saying we're for Gillard, etc. When it came to Rudd making an assessment of things, it seemed to me that the sort of issue he'd have to wrestle with is, if he were going to challenge, given we all knew the history of what happened with Keating and Hawke back in 1991, if, say, he were to get something like 41, 42 votes, then we would have known that the party would remain very unstable. Why? Because he was much more popular than Keating, and Gillard was less popular than Hawke. There's then not just questions of consequences and political assessment, there's also questions of prudence and civic virtue, and if you're a religious person, questions about, well, what is for the greater good? What might help with the breaking in of the kingdom? Or is this simply likely to unfurl the party completely, where I would simply to be seen to be acting in my own self-interest?
Scott, Kevin Rudd, given his profession of Anglicanism, is he the man to usher in the kingdom, or was he the man to usher in the kingdom? Or did he have tickets on himself about that?
Well, you know, listening to Frank, the phrase that keeps coming to mind is, thou almost persuadest me. I'm afraid my feelings about Rudd and his political ambitions, but also his political posture, the moral disposition, I suppose, that he brings to his role, are slightly more ambivalent. I mean, it seems to me that some of the very highfalutin, elevated language that we saw of the last week Yes, it was trying to raise the stakes, if you like, through the roof. It was trying to demonstrate something of the gravity of the decision that the caucus was going to have to make on Monday. But at the same time, there is this tendency for Kevin Rudd to cast himself in a kind of impossibly heroic posture by placing himself at the center, where if he pulls it off, well and good, and of course he can then bask in the glory of it. But what I'm more interested in is what happens when it doesn't come off. What happens when he fails? And unfortunately, I suppose, Andrew, I was a little bit less impressed by his quite faint offer of forgiveness to those who might have injured him, but also a request for repentance from those that he might have injured himself. There's a great deal in Rudd's own political rhetoric that it seems to me tends to blame others. And this is what I've written about. It's as if he tries to take upon himself the mantle of a kind of martyr. And in taking on himself the mantle of a political or moral martyr, it gives him the opportunity, if you like, to bask in that glory and praise that, according to T.S. Eliot, is owing to martyrs alone, but which stands as the great temptation to martyrdom itself.
Frank, you know Kevin Rudd. Is Scott being a little harsh there? Does he wish upon himself martyrdom?
Well, I think he's being a bit rough on him, but, you know, we're here in the public square and people formulate their own views. I think, sure, Kevin, I think from time to time uses very inflated language, but I do think it has to be conceded that, you know, I mean, he is a prayerful person, he is a person who's informed by the scriptures, and yes, some of the great scriptural narratives he sees in part being played out in our contemporary world. I think he's the only sort of person who could, for example, have brought off the Aboriginal apology in the way that he did.
Something very close to your heart.
Well, indeed. But, see, I don't think that Julia Gillard could have, even if she uttered the very same words of the apology, I don't think it would have had the same poignancy, because I think what was reflected there was more of Rudd's meta-narrative about what we're about in terms of reconciliation and moving forward. And I saw a hint of that yet again in what went on in terms of his concession once this vindictive battle was over. But, you know, I don't think he's any saint. I don't think he claims to be any saint. But I think it is necessary to acknowledge that, I mean, you can conduct yourself in political life and say, well, it is just a matter of whatever takes and winner takes all. And yes, someone could just stand up before the caucus and say, well, I gave it my best shot, had only one shot in the locker and that's it. Or there might be something more to be drawn from it in terms of what do we make of loss and how do we work together in terms of being reconciled once we've torn each other apart in this sort of way. Now, those of us of a Christian background, I think there is a narrative that we have there which is imbued within us, which does help with the articulation of some of that. But to those who don't share that religious faith, or to those who are profoundly cynical or just don't like someone like Kevin Rudd, then I think, understandably, it will ring hollow, or they'll say, well, that's not for us.
Let's step back, though, from the person of Kevin Rudd. Scott, what does the Bible say about humility?
Oh, my goodness. Well, look, it says a great deal about humility, and in fact, probably the most radical thing that the Bible claims about humility is that humility is, in a very real sense, an essential attribute of God himself, so much so that what it means for God to, in fact, be God, according to Philippians 2, is for God to humble himself. In other words, that's not something that runs against the divine nature. It's not a kind of exception to the divine rule of elevation and transcendence and glory. But in fact, it's in humiliation itself, it's in the very act of humility and becoming the servant of all, that one best expresses the divine nature. This is why humility in politics suddenly becomes so problematic. When you begin applying certain forms of moral rhetoric within political discourse, it becomes profoundly easy for the person employing that rhetoric, and this is something that Max Weber saw over a century ago, to begin luxuriating, if you like, in their own moral disposition. In other words, they begin enjoying a little bit too much the spectacle about them being humble. And what Max Weber saw and argued for quite powerfully is that Christians really ought to think twice before engaging in the political process, because politics is about essentially two things. On the one hand, it's about the use of force. And at the same time, it's about the bringing out of good ends through, at best, dubious means. And he said, because of that, Christians really ought to think twice about whether their convictions can really enable them to participate in this political process. And I think if one believes that humility is, in fact, a virtue, which I do, I think it's one of the chiefest of virtues, then it ought to make this kind of political engagement a bit problematic.
Yes, I'd agree with everything Scott has said there.
What does Matthew say about, I think, about humility? Whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall be humble shall himself be exalted. That's not the way politics works, though, is it?
It's not, but you can't simply transpose, you know, a verse of the New Testament into the life of politics. I mean, it's simplistic, of course, to observe that Jesus himself had no interest in engaging in the political life of the Roman Empire. He was there to proclaim a message of direct conversion to individuals. And yes, there are all sorts of verses that you can quote one way or another, but I think ultimately for the Christian who says to him or herself that I feel a calling to engage in public life, then I think where the scriptures can help to inform is the person would say, well, I will engage as well as anybody else in the cunning of the calculation of the consequences of politics. I will engage as competently as anyone else in what are the rules of civic virtue. But yes, I will see myself as called one step further, particularly in terms of the dying to self and according the human dignity of all. And so the really big challenge for the person of Christian disposition will be, how do I affect the compromises on, for example, the poor, the marginalised, the disabled, the indigenous people, the asylum seekers, while holding together the need to be popularly elected, the need to be able to hold a coherent political message which the majority will comply with. Very easy for, you know, well-meaning clerics like myself on the side to say, thou shalt not. But to be engaged in that, ultimately what's required is persons of extraordinary dignity able to do that, true to their faith.
But you're not just a well-meaning cleric on the side, Frank. You're a very distinguished jurist, and for 25 years you have been at the heart of big political debates and been very close to prime ministers and ministers. Is it your view that that if you're a Christian, politics, the process of politics, can corrupt you? I don't mean criminally corrupt you, although that does happen from time to time, but ethically corrupt you.
Of course it can.
In what way?
In the way that you have to make decisions where, with deep regret, I mean, figuratively, you're left with blood on your hands. Take, for example, the most contested issue in contemporary Australia, the so-called Malaysia solution or whatever for asylum seekers. Now, it's very easy for someone like myself to say, well, look, there's a simple test you apply to the Malaysia solution. That is, what would you do with unaccompanied minors? Either you take them to Malaysia, which if you do, it's morally repugnant, or you don't, in which case the scheme doesn't work. Therefore, not on. But if you're Mr. Bowen, if you're a senior bureaucrat trying to formulate a proposal which responds to the needs for national security, border security, and responding to the electorate at large, it becomes impossibly more complex. And in the end, you do make decisions where there will be people who fall through the cracks and where wrong will be done to them by the state because of decisions you've made. And ultimately, you'll have to seek forgiveness for that before you're gone. Mm-hmm.
How does that square with you, Scott?
I think Frank's exactly right. And in fact, that's where a responsibility, and again, if I can just go back, Max Weber saw that there are three things that fundamentally have to all be in harness within political behavior: passion or conviction, responsibility, and proportion. Simply owning the bad decisions that one makes as being one's own fault and having the courage to, in fact, ask for forgiveness from them. But I think what Frank is saying is actually holding out another possibility altogether. I mean, politics is a fundamentally corrupting exercise, precisely because it's based on the use of force and it can often use dubious means. But I think what Frank is holding out is another possibility, that maybe force at the hands of an authentic Christian politician, force can perhaps be translated into persuasion, that ambition can perhaps transmute over to authentic collegiality, and that this willingness to do whatever it takes can in fact be replaced by virtue. Now, that would mean that the political process would grind almost to a halt, that one would have to be far more deliberative, far more collegial, far more patient. But it does mean that with a certain amount of humility and a certain amount even of self-sacrifice, that there is something within this political process that could in fact be redeemed.
I like that.
One of the basest elements of politics, though, is revenge. It's getting square. And that clearly is not biblical. We are exhorted to leave revenge or vengeance to God, aren't we, Frank?
We are, but my God, Elijah wiped out all the prophets of Baal. You know, you don't want to go too deep into this.
But Frank, it's slightly glib to quote Elijah and Baal. I mean, the New Testament, at least in Catholic teaching, unequivocally supersedes the Hebrew, notion of vengeance. I mean, its command to forgive and not take revenge is pretty clear.
Yes.
Okay. I thought you were going to say something more, but anyway, all right.
Well, I mean, Jesus several times, I mean, woe to you Pharisees and scribes, and what was called down upon them for their hypocrisy was, I think it was vengeful, and there's no getting away from that. So that it's always a very mixed message, even with Jesus.
So getting square can be okay in politics.
I'm sure that there are some who get square in politics who do so in good faith. Now, there are others who get square in politics for whom it is simply a primitive revenge, or where the consequentialism which kicks in takes no regard to the common good of the party, of the government, or of the nation.
If you don't mind my saying, Frank, that is a Jesuitical answer.
I'm delighted to hear it, and I'm sure Bob Drynan would agree.
Scott? What a superb answer. What a wonderful answer. Look, I'm afraid I would actually be probably a little bit more robust about this. I mean, my God, how on earth could our elected officials begin really advocating for authentic forms of civility and civic virtue when they refuse to exemplify precisely that virtue with their own colleagues? So I do believe that there is far more of a place, not just for forgiveness, but for very public forgiveness, for very public reconciliation in this kind of political sphere.
Finally, do you think that the Rudd drama, this ascension to the leadership, the election victory, flying too close to the sun, the downfall, this seems to me to be a morality tale, doesn't it?
It is, and best summed up in the tears of Anthony Albanese. And to say, look, we're committed to fairness, and to hear him say there he is, brought up by a single mum, and what, she was a Catholic. He's remained true to ideas about Catholic social teaching, that he follows a football club that's never won in its life, but he sticks by them, and that he stands for Labour. That sort of thing, doesn't matter whether you're a Labour voter, what you think of Albanese or whatever you say, thank God those tears were wept, and thank God that heart and mind were torn apart and then put on public display for us to take home as a take-home message.
Scott, what's the moral message coming out of the Rudd rise and spectacular fall?
That political passion or political conviction has to be allied with a sense of proportion and responsibility. And I think at the moment, unfortunately from Rudd's side, we saw a great deal of passion, a great deal of conviction. But throughout his term as Prime Minister, there doesn't seem to have been that corresponding sense of proportion and humility. I think from Gillard's side, unfortunately, we see a certain amount of proportion and responsibility. But what people are actively lamenting, and this is the real message coming out of this, I mean, have we ever heard more public calls for a return to authentic conviction politics? And so I think there's something to be learned here. These need to be joined once again.
One final point. Do either of you think that this is a case of Kevin Rudd effectively being denied the prime ministership until the moment that he no longer wants it? And maybe then the divine will intervene and give him something that he has stopped craving.
I don't think there'll be any divine intervention in terms of the workings of the Labour Party. Basically, from here it's all over until they come if they ever come cap in hand and say, given your popularity, we want you to do something. Very unlikely. But in the meantime, then he's got to be there converting his popularity into something that can work for the Gillard government.
But Scott, speaking theologically, I mean, is there not something in that, that once we cease to crave something so much, it may be given to us?
Do you know, Andrew, I really think you're onto something. And let me sort of evoke one of Rudd's great heroes, who is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer said that certain spiritual exercises and practices and forms of godliness get corrupted as soon as we become the audience to our own prayers. In other words, as soon as we begin enjoying a little bit too much the process of seeing ourselves being very pious. I do wonder how much Kevin Rudd has become just a little bit obsessed, and it's almost reflected, if you like, through his popular appeal, through opinion polls and whatever else. He's almost become an audience to his own political drama. I would hope, so Bonhoeffer's great advice, of course, was that your works of righteousness ought to be visible to all, but invisible to yourself. I would hope that perhaps Rudd's own ambition, but also his very deep and very moral convictions about what the common good looks like and what political process ought to follow, I would really hope that that might, in fact, once that becomes, if you like, invisible to himself and just becomes pure political virtue, hopefully maybe things might come around once again.